Welcome to episode 27 of the Serious About Security podcast for February 15th, 2013, brought to you by the Center for Education and Research in Information Assurance and Security, or SERIAS, at Purdue University. I'm Preston Wiley, and let me introduce the hosts. We also have Keith Watson and Mike Hill for this podcast, and we're going to start out with the first article, which I believe is Mike's.
Yes, in the first article today, we're going to be talking about an iOS 6 bug that lets anyone unlock your phone bypassing your passcode. So an article came out on CNN?
CNET.
CNET, that's it. Thank you, Keith. I knew that wasn't right. CNET, describing how this hack can occur. User uploaded a video to YouTube, which basically involves kind of almost like entering a cheat code if you played video games. You basically go through this key sequence where you turn the phone off, you turn it on, you place an emergency call, you cancel it. You go through this sequence of events, and what you end up with is unlocking the phone, and you have full access to the phone app. So at that point, you can make phone calls. You could go through the contacts list, and I even read something that if you go to the contact list and you go to the photo of the contact, you might be able to get to pictures on the phone. It appears if you try to do anything beyond that with an iPhone that you just you get back to the passcode screen. So this hack was discovered, and Apple has made a statement that they're going to release a patch, but there's nothing currently available. There's really nothing you can do as an iPhone user to prevent this from happening, you know, because it works with the simple PIN passcodes, but it also works with the passcodes that involve more than four digits that are numbers or letters as well. So, you know, not a lot that can be done yet at this point to prevent this from happening. And so it's been making some rounds. A lot of articles have been coming out about it, kind of just warning people that this hack exists. I did see something that they had a similar bug back in iOS 4. So, you know, this has happened to Apple before, apparently. And my thoughts on that are, because of the way a phone functions and you have to give emergency call features, there must be hackers must be able to exploit some kind of vulnerability, that something got put into the software with this latest round of iOS 6 that they were able to exploit. I don't quite understand how they were able to figure out the key sequence that they have, because it's a weird sequence. It's not something I think you would necessarily try unless you're just pushing a bunch of different buttons and seeing what can happen. But that is something that is available right now. So iPhone users need to be aware, at least if you're running iOS 6, which I believe you have to have an iPhone 4S or later, and if you're running one of the latest versions, your phone is vulnerable to this. Probably the best advice right now that I could give would be just to keep the device in your possession, which is really, you know, good advice anyway, and just to recognize that a passcode helps deter people from getting into your phone, but it's not necessarily going to prevent everyone from being able to get into it. And right now, a vulnerability exists that allows anyone to get into your phone app. So what do you guys think about this?
Well, I'm wondering why cell phones have kind of this emergency access to dial the phone. So I did a little looking while you were speaking to see if I could find anything that says, hey, you know, the law is that every cell phone has to have a way to bypass the lock screen to get to a way you can dial the phone. I haven't found anything to indicate why that is. And the reason I think that's a problem is, I think it, you know, if there's no requirement in law or by the FCC to provide emergency access to a phone, then there should be a way to turn that off. And I, while this may not fix the problem here, it may reduce the opportunity for vulnerabilities to be found where somebody could bypass the lock screen. Do you guys know if that's law or FCC requirement? I've not come across that before yet. My Android phone has a similar sort of thing where you have on the lock screen an emergency dialer.
Yeah, I don't know either, but I think pretty much every phone that's come out in recent memory has had that feature. Even the old phones, I believe, that had the, you know, the handset would lock and you had to push, hold a key down in order to dial. I've had one of those. If you dialed 911 on that phone without unlocking it, it would actually dial that number. So it was one of those. I think it's one of those features that is there just in case you have an absolute emergency and it's hard for you to, you know, dial to unlock your phone and type in things and stuff like that. I mean,
well, I don't disagree. I see the reason for it. I'm just wondering where it says in the law or FCC rule that says all phones have to have that. I've not found that. So
I don't know if there is a requirement for it, but I think it's just an understanding that phones are one of their purposes is an emergency device, but I don't know if they're legally required to do that. I mean, they are obviously the cell phone carriers are required to deal with 911 service. They are legally required to do that. So I'm not sure if they're legally required to make it easy to use those 911 services.
Right. And I know that if you're a wireline telephone provider, that even if the telephone service has been terminated at an address, I believe there's a requirement from the FCC, or maybe it's state law, because I know this is true in California when I live there. Even if the telephone has been disconnected, you still have to be able to dial 911 on that phone and get through to emergency service. Can't dial anywhere else, but you can dial. Maybe you can call the company and say, "I'd like to put service on this phone," but they had to support dialing 911 even for disconnected phones.
Yeah, and I believe that's true with the cell phones as well. That even when you terminate service with a cell phone, I believe that you can still dial 911 and that call has to be completed. I think that's why they collect a lot of those cell phones and they hand them out. I believe it has to fulfill the 911 call. But I'm not aware of any law necessarily that states it, but I would imagine that the Android and Apple devices would get a lot of flack if they took that emergency call feature away.
Yeah, and I'm still looking here for an article that may explain this, but it seems to me that the emergency mode may have been one way to bypass this the lock screen and get access to some parts of the phone and contacts. And I wonder if by removing that emergency dialer option, if that would have prevented that. It's not clear, obviously. We don't know, but if you can't, that sequence didn't work.
Yeah, it wasn't clear.
Would there be another sequence that might, or just the fact that you're accessing the phone dialing app and you have to provide that through a bypass in the lock screen, and that interaction is where the vulnerability lies. So maybe you could prevent this one. Would you prevent others? It's not clear.
Yeah, and I, you know, again, there wasn't any details. To me, using the video game analogy, a lot of times those cheat codes, those were back doors in the gaming software. So, you know, was this specifically, was there a back door designed during the testing phase and then it was just left in when it went and, you know, when the software was released? You know, like I said, it's not an obvious set of sequences that you have to follow, but it's not that difficult to do either. Almost like it was by design, if you do this sequence in this way, you can bypass certain features. And I could see maybe while developing things and testing things, they might have that backdoor there, but would close it off. I mean, nothing in the article stated it was a backdoor by Apple, but I just wonder why a particular sequence, how someone was able to determine how to get into that, unless they were just picking up the phone and just trying random things and got lucky and came across something.
Well, there are people with lots of time on their hand, and maybe that's what they do. I don't know. Or it could be somebody said, "Hey, by the way," an insider perhaps said, "I know this way to bypass the lock screen. Check it out." It's one of those insider information sorts of things.
I think we call those people security researchers, don't we? Who
Sometimes.
have a lot of time on their hands and just do things just to try and break stuff.
Sometimes, yes. It depends on if that's their primary job. Then they do tend to spend a lot of time doing that, maybe.
Well, I find it interesting that they had a similar vulnerability in iOS 4, and it comes back again in iOS 6. Like I said, I wonder if there's some reason, if there's some code being left around because it has a really useful testing purpose, but it keeps getting snuck back in, or maybe someone's working with old software and checks it in, and so it has a flaw in it, or maybe it's just not related and it's just a coincidence. But I find coincidences like that to be hard to come by. So I wonder what the issue might have been here that allowed this to happen. But I think. Because of the emergency call mode, and again, I think it's something they're going to have to support. It kind of gives a window of opportunity there if people can work around that, like they did in this case. They can get into the phone. But with that being said, all they can do is use your phone app. Now, maybe if you have a very limited data plan and they're calling Russia and talking for 18 hours, they're going to cost you a lot of money. But everything I read said it could not break out of the phone app, so it couldn't get into other apps on your device, like your Dropbox app, where you could get to confidential documents, for example, or something along those lines.
Okay. All right. Well, the other article we were going to talk about today is not really an article so much as it is the presidential executive order that President Obama signed, I believe, prior to his State of the Union address. And he mentioned it in the State of the Union address, and then this was published shortly after that by the press secretary. And basically, the title is Improving Critical Infrastructure Cybersecurity, and is in some respects kind of a follow-on to some other attempts at cybersecurity legislation in the previous Congress. And this is an attempt to kind of spur further movement in that area and to do it through the process of an executive order. Now, if the executive orders, they're not law. They are totally up to the president to decide what to do, and it only typically applies to the executive branch of government. However, the executive branch of government is the biggest branch of government, so it does affect quite a few things, but mostly federal agencies. So this one in particular talks a lot about collaboration, coordination, developing policies. It kind of leaves out any real teeth in terms of enforcement outside of federal government. So that's a problem. I think the idea here was that, and it might be all politics, the president wanted to make some advancement in addressing cybersecurity issues that have not so far occurred through the legislative branch. So you'll see a lot if you read through it, and it's rather lengthy, but it talks a lot about, defining what our critical infrastructure is, developing policies, sharing information, which we can talk about later. Also, there's discussion of protecting privacy and civil liberties, which was a big concern with the previous legislation that had been proposed. And I don't know that this addresses that adequately yet. The other one was very intrusive. This one is probably just as intrusive, but they just say, "Hey, we looked at it. It's okay." That'll have to be reviewed a little bit more, probably. There's discussion about creating baseline frameworks. There's a lot of voluntary critical infrastructure that has to be done. I'm just looking through the list here so I can point out a few things. There's discussion about involving various federal agencies in developing this framework we talked about. And then yeah, so it's kind of like hey, look, we're doing something, but what gets done, it mostly applies to federal government, where the problem is that even though the federal government, has some responsibility for critical infrastructure, at least by the way it's defined, most of that infrastructure is owned by private organizations. So some of the cybersecurity legislation that was being proposed would have required the private owners of critical infrastructure to increase their cybersecurity defense, but didn't really fund it. It just labeled, leveled a bunch of requirements on those organizations, saying, you have to be now, in addition to all the other compliance issues you have, you now have cybersecurity compliance to worry about too. This doesn't do that. Like again, it mostly applies to federal agencies. So probably the biggest one that that they talk about, but we don't see a lot of good movement on, is this idea of information sharing. Ideally, we'd want to see the federal government share more with private sector, but from my understanding is that doesn't happen a whole lot. It's a kind of a one-way sharing. Those entities report information to the federal government, and then the federal government never shares anything that they hear, from multiple organizations. So there's that. And then the other problem, which I found kind of funny, is our own government has been implicated in creating cyber war weapons and launching them in many cases, specifically Iran with Stuxnet. And yet, this is like, say, hey, we need to protect our own infrastructure from ourselves. Watch out, people. So I found that interesting.
Well, I think, I mean, even though I think pretty much this whole thing is voluntary, I think creating frameworks, policies, standards, and things like that that are an example for the private companies to use is, assuming they're not bad policies, standards, or frameworks, I think is the first step in getting the private sector organizations to actually do something. I mean, it's difficult to create a security program, especially if you don't really have one, and giving them the tools to kind of not start from ground zero and have something in place, I think is valuable, assuming it is, they're good. But I think until we have either a law that requires them to do it or some major incident, I don't think much is going to happen.
Yeah, you may be right. And I agree that frameworks are good, but I think the framework should be developed with the private sector, not developed by federal government and handed over to the private sector. And I'm not sure that that's what this is going to do yet. There's an open public review and comment process, of course, but usually by that point, it's a little late to make major changes to any sort of framework. So, if they said, "Hey, we're gonna involve private industry in development," or we're gonna say, "You guys develop it, and we'll support that as the standard," that's one way to do it, but it doesn't seem to be that approach.
Yeah, I wonder how much will actually happen too. I think it's great to have a start, but it's being voluntary. I just, as Preston mentioned, until a major incident happens, not that we want one to happen, but I just don't think people take these things all that seriously, and they don't understand the impact of, what the fallout would be from a major cybersecurity attack. And I'm glad to see things moving forward in the direction, but in a sense, it would have been nice to have seen maybe, I guess, more stronger language. It would say we are going to, at a minimum, do these things instead of it being more voluntary in nature. And I know it's hard just to get started with something, but it'd been nice to see some actions that would say these things are going to take place, you know, these very low level things, and then build on those.
Right. And I think that thanks to the FISMA law, which required federal government agencies to implement their own information security management practices, and the fact that that required NIST to develop those standards and publish that, they've got a lot to start with. Now, obviously the federal government agency approach to information security is going to be different than private sector, but at least there's something out there right now that NIST has already done, which will be a good starting point. Maybe it's overly cumbersome for a private sector and they could just trim some of what's in there out. That might be one approach too. So it kind of remains to be seen what's going to happen. I know that according to this, the executive order says that NIST basically, I think it says NIST. NIST is basically the one on the hook for developing those standards, and that makes sense. They've done it before.
All right, and with that, we'll wrap it up. I want to thank the hosts of the podcast, Keith Watson and Mike Hill. I'm Preston Wiley. Have a safe and secure day.